You've probably heard a few stories over the years about couples who got married and then had strange experiences on their honeymoons. How about a world war? That is the backdrop for the wedding of a couple of American journalists working in Asia in the early 1940s. War was already waging in Europe, Japan and China were at war, and Mel Jacoby and Anna Lee Whitmore drew closer together. They married in the Philippines just before Pearl Harbor, and the advance of Japan's military forced them to flee. It's a story told in great detail by Bill Lasher in the book Eve of a Hundred Nights. Bill Lasher is a journalist. His work has been published in a variety of places, including The Guardian, Portland Monthly, and Gizmodo. He is based in Portland. Bill Lasher, welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Good to have you. It turns out this is something of a family story for you. Tell us of the connection.
Yeah, that's right. So Mel Jacoby was, well, actually the best way to tell it is about 10 years ago, I was starting my professional career as a journalist, and my grandmother was moving at the time. And she gave me a gift that she had found in her house as she moved. It was an old box, and I opened it up, and inside was this old Corona 4 typewriter. And my grandmother told me, this typewriter used to belong to my cousin, the war correspondent. And I thought to myself, that's strange. I don't remember ever hearing about your cousin, the war correspondent. And what had happened was his memory had just sort of, you know, fallen behind the, you know, mists of history. And she started to tell me about this man who had been her oldest cousin. He had gone to China as an exchange student and kept going back as a freelance journalist because he felt it was really important to cover the war that was happening there. And over the years, we started talking, and soon enough, it was a book after looking at all of this man Mel Jacoby's letters and photographs and things like that.
So it sounds like the fascination took hold pretty much the second the typewriter was in your hand.
Yeah, it really did. I mean, it's a beautiful machine, but also just being able to connect with my grandmother about something deeper about our family's background was a really wonderful thing. And the fact that she saw this connection between sort of my eagerness to become a journalist and what he had done as a young man who was about the same age, but doing far more adventurous things than I was doing.
So our first glimpse of the past is right there in Manila near the end of 1941. What was the general situation as the beginning of 1942 approached?
Well, you know, right after Pearl Harbor, Manila was bombed almost as heavily as Pearl Harbor was. And for the next 3 or 4 weeks, the U.S. forces in the Philippines were fighting the Japanese, and eventually Japanese landed forces in the Philippines. And it became clear that the U.S. would have to surrender Manila. And so General Douglas MacArthur declared it a open city, said they weren't going to defend it. His hope was to limit civilian deaths there and move the forces to Corregidor, an island fortress in the bay, and, of course, to the Bataan Peninsula, where U.S. and Filipino forces fought a very desperate fight against the Japanese. But for civilians in Manila, like Melville and Emily Jacoby, this meant having to decide if they wanted to risk what might happen as the Japanese invaded Manila. They were expected to arrive on the morning of New Year's Day, or decide to flee but not know where they could go because the entire Philippines were surrounded. The bay just outside of Manila was mined by the Americans, and it was really uncertain where they would be able to go, since now the entire Pacific was a battlefield.
Why was Mel Jacoby so sure that the Japanese would want him dead if they caught him?
He had been a reporter in China for 2 years before Pearl Harbor. He had, for a brief time, worked with the Chinese government, helping them provide radio broadcasts of news in China that were sent to the United States, sort of as a propagandist. And then he left because he wanted to do real journalism. So he went to what was then called French Indochina, which is now Vietnam, as well as Laos and Cambodia, to report on the Japanese advances there. And while he was there, he was arrested by Japanese troops who were occupying an American warehouse. This is a year before Pearl Harbor. So to see, you know, foreign soldiers in an American warehouse that was flying the American flag would have been quite a dramatic scene, and definitely worth reporting on. The Japanese accused him of being a spy, and then they turned him over to the French Vichy forces that were in Indochina, and Mel was forced to carry a bodyguard the rest of the time he was in Indochina, and then basically worry about the possibility of arrest any time he would encounter Japanese forces again. So he knew that he had angered them and that he was marked to death the way that many other journalists were.
What drew him to that part of the world initially? I mean, especially at what was a fairly insular time in American history.
You know, he was somewhat of a rootless young man when he started college, and he didn't quite know what he wanted to do. Then, after his sophomore year at Stanford, he won an essay contest that was offering a trip abroad to study in a place called Lingnan University, which is in what then Westerners called Canton, what we now refer to as Guangzhou, in southern China. And so he went there as an exchange student. And when he was there, he was so fascinated by this other country, by the fact that, there was this country sort of in this evolution from having been a monarchy, an empire for so long, and then, becoming a republic. But of course, it was also threatened by Japan at the same time. And while Mel was there, Japan invaded China. And he realized when he got back to the United States that the Americans weren't covering it, despite a sort of increasing importance of Asia to the West Coast, particularly, but the United States in general. And he was frustrated that there wasn't proper news coverage about that area. So he made that sort of his mission for the next few years in school of covering it, and also made internationalism in general a bigger issue, partially because of the sort of dangers that were appearing in Asia, as well as in Europe with the rise of the Nazis and the fascists. And there was, a group of people that thought that there needed to be more international cooperation to prevent the war that sadly did end up happening.
It's interesting to hear him complain about people not being interested in what was going on in the world around them, which is still a complaint about American journalism 75 years later. We'll talk more with Bill Lasher about the book Eve of 100 Midnights, the star-crossed story of two World War II correspondents and their epic escape across the Pacific. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Bill Lasher and the story of Mel Jacoby and Anna Lee Whitmore Jacoby, and your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is the Portland-based journalist Bill Lasher. He's written a large and handsome book about a couple of lovers who were also journalists in World War II called Eve of 100 Midnights. It's the story of Mel Jacoby and Anna Lee Whitmore working in the Far East at a time when war was already raging. They got married in Manila just days before Pearl Harbor and had to escape the advancing Japanese forces. The story is told in Eve of 100 Nights by Bill Lasher. You can join us on the Exchange with questions or comments about that time in history. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We talked pretty much exclusively about Mel Jacoby so far because there is a blood relation there. He was your grandmother's cousin. Anna Lee, his new wife, what brought her to China in the first place?
Well, Anna Lee was always engaged and intellectually driven woman ever since a young age. So she had ended up at Stanford as one of the highest ranking people on the English entrance exams. There was the first female managing editor of the Stanford Daily. Always was interested in journalism as well as other forms of writing. And so after Stanford, she went on to work for a variety of New Deal organizations, the Agricultural Adjustment Administration. But she was getting frustrated because she kept getting sent into roles as a as a secretary rather than having opportunities to do her own writing and reporting. She ended up in Los Angeles, where she got a job as a stenographer at MGM. But what she really wanted to do was write scripts. So one day when she was working as an assistant for a director down there, he needed a script written over the weekend. And so she took it on with a writing partner. They finished it by the end of the weekend, and it was turned out to be a very big commercial success. It was called Andy Hardy Meets Debutante. So they gave her a job as a screenwriter and an office. And it was great for her. It was a great career opportunity, but she still wasn't fulfilled because she felt like that work was not as meaningful as it could have been. You know, she was hearing, she was politically engaged, she was socially engaged. So she knew there was this conflict erupting in China. She knew that, you know, thousands of people were getting killed there, millions eventually. And then she knew what was going on elsewhere in the world and felt that she wanted to find out for herself what was happening. And so she started looking for journalism work. And it was that search for journalism work that ended up putting her in touch with Mel Jacoby.
Interesting to think that she was at the pinnacle of American pop culture, in a sense, because here she was writing the script for this movie, Andy Hardy Meets Debutante, with Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland, who is still in the peak, as you point out, of her post-Wizard of Oz fame. So, but she turned that behind because she wanted to go off and do things that she thought were more important for the world. Let's back up to beginnings, Bill, because Mel Jacoby grew up in L.A. How early did he show a knack for writing?
I mean, he was writing for writing small little stories in his grammar school newspaper. He edited the sports coverage at one of the schools that he went to. And then in high school, he reported for his student newspaper. So he really was writing from a very young age, and he was also doing a lot of exploration and, you know, what was then hilly and rural Hollywood Hills. So he sort of was mixing that sort of sense of adventure with his interest in writing and telling stories.
Well, I mean, more than a writer, he was also a keen observer. As you point out, he took a trip to Europe while he was a student at Stanford University and was looking for things other than what tourists would see.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. He, you know, I was fortunate enough to have these letters home that he wrote from places like that trip to Stanford or later when he was in China. And what you see is him seeing, this is in 1936, but he's already seen the machine of war getting ready for what would be World War II. In England, he saw ships being built, you know, 24 hours a day. In when he was in Switzerland, even though Switzerland was neutral, he saw Nazi agents on the streets trying to recruit Swiss people to join the Nazi cause. In Italy, he ended up getting malaria and being sort of stuck in a room for a week in a pensione. And as he was looking out the window, he could see fascists marching down the streets. And then I think of most relevance to our current era, he went on to Marseille to begin the trip that would take him to China. And in Marseille, he was seeing a lot of agitation from refugees from the Spanish Civil War and a lot of concerns about what was happening there and the fact that, you know, there's a lot of resistance then to these refugees coming from this war-torn land. And, you know, there in France, there was concern about what they would do to the country. And, you know, he was observing that and observing the sort of hostility towards them and also the agitation these refugees were making about their own political situation. So I think that that's something telling about him, that he recognized these pressures that were happening on the world situation long before, I think, a lot of domestic observers were seeing that.
Bill Lasher's our guest. He's from Portland. He wrote a book about the journalists in World War II, Mel Jacoby and Annalee Whitmore, and their ill-starred marriage. The book is called Eve of 100 Midnights. The despite the fact that Mel Jacoby was pretty good at looking at what was going on in the world and seeing things that other people might not have noticed, how interested was he in sharing his observations with anybody as a journalist?
You know, at first he kind of was saying, "No, I don't think I want to do this." He was really humble, and so there's some letters from that time when he was an exchange student. He said, "Oh, I don't see any interest in being a journalist. If, you know, there's other people who can do it better." And you know, he was in, for example, when he was in China, he went to Beijing right when right after Japan had invaded and had attacked Beijing, and he went and met up with some newspaper editors, and he just thought, oh, they can do it better, and I'm not going to add any. I think, as he put it, why should I contribute a little bit more trash? Then, yeah, you know, it was what that feeling of going home and studying. He ended up getting a master's degree in journalism, and he wrote his thesis with another man about China, how China and Japan were being covered by U.S. newspapers. And he just realized that the editors of these newspapers, and specifically in California, were just sort of picking and choosing what they wanted, trying to play up the stories to sound more horrific and, you know, sort of attention grabbing, you know, really creating, you know, he was having the same frustrations I think we hear today about people trying to create viral headlines but not really looking beneath the surface of things. And I think he just realized if no one else reported these things, he would have to.
So he wanted to go beyond the tales of atrocities and body counts and get into something like the actual political situations that were forcing people into doing things they were doing.
Yeah, I think that's a really accurate assessment.
He's in Lingnan as an exchange student from Stanford, and from that base, how far and wide was he able to travel in Asia just in that period of his life?
Well, just in that period, and so when he was 20 years old, in fact, he arrived on his 20th birthday. He went to Hong Kong plenty of times. They went to Macau. Both of those places are very close to Guangzhou. And then he had a roommate who was from nearby Guangxi province, which is just to the west of that area. And he went there to visit his roommate's sort of ancestral home and see what it was like in the countryside there and in the region nearby. And then after the exchange year was up, he and another American student took a boat to Shanghai, and then they went from Shanghai all the way through the interior of China out to Xi'an, which was the ancient capital of China, and went to some other places in the northwest of China, went to the edge of the Mongolian border. He had to cut the trip short because of the war and the fact that the war had occurred, so the borders were being closed off, and there was a danger that if he didn't get back to Beijing, he would be he would be prevented from traveling home on a ship. He even went to Japan on that same journey before it became dangerous for him to go to Japan.
Wow, he really was quite omnivorous in what he was willing to look at across the world. The book is called Eve of 100 Midnights, the star-crossed love story of two World War II correspondents and their epic escape across the Pacific. Bill Lasher from Portland is its author and our guest on The Exchange. You can join us if you have some questions about what you're hearing here or some observations of your own to share about the early days of World War II in the Pacific. We'd like to hear them at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. He seems to have had a knack for bumping into people. I love the tale of coming home from Lingnan on the ship and meeting Helen Keller.
Yeah, that's just right. He had a knack for meeting people. And on that ship, he had left from Japan, and he heard that there was a woman on board that was interested in the situation in China and concerned about what it meant for the regular people there and for the children that were living there and the children also in Manchuria and other parts of Asia that were under conflict and were threatened. And he went and met her, and it turned out that it was Helen Keller, and he was able to communicate with her aide, Polly Thompson, who had, of course, replaced the miracle worker. And she was there as sort of a you know, on her own humanitarian tour of Asia, but she herself had been turned back from, she had gone to Korea and had gone to Japan, but she hadn't been able to go to China because of the war. So she wanted to hear from him what the conditions were like there. And here, I guess you could say, just listen to him through her own way of communicating.
Right, right. It was pretty fascinating. She would listen to feel his vocal cords as he talked. The way that Helen Keller communicated it's still astounding. So then Mel Jacoby graduates from Stanford, then enrolls in the graduate journalism program. This is a bit of a difference from when he thought he didn't want to contribute any more trash to the world. So who were some of the people who helped guide him and cultivate his interest in journalism and sharing his stories?
Well, there was his advisor, one of the founders of the journalism program there was a man named Chilton Bush, who was involved also in the Institute for Pacific Relations, which was a sort of a think tank looking at cross-Pacific affairs. A lot of people from the United Press came to listen to some of Mel's findings from his graduate thesis. And then those people all sent Mel to China with letters of recommendation to find work there. So he was able to really hit the ground running when he returned there. And it still was a struggle, but through this network and then a further network he made with the journalists who were working in first in Shanghai, he met agents of the Chinese government who needed someone to do some propaganda work to, translate what Chinese officials were writing, and not just translate in a language sense, but also translate in terms of helping the American culture understand what was happening in China. And so he met Hollington Tong, who was one of the key aides to Chiang Kai-shek, and he met Chiang Kai-shek and Madame Chiang Kai-shek and her sisters, Ching Ling and Ai Ling, and helped them sort of get the message out about their fight against Japan. And over the years, he met a lot of other important people. He met Henry Luce on the plane on the way back to Asia. And Henry Luce was the founder of Time and Life magazine. Also in China, he became very, very dear friends with Teddy White, a journalist who ended up writing about China for Time for many years and then ended up being a chronicler of presidential administrations. So he really met a lot of the important people involved in journalism in that era. And later, people like Douglas MacArthur became his friends and Manuel Quezon, the first president of the Philippines. So as you noted earlier, he had a way of being in the right place at the right time.
Well, and a knack for being able to do just about anything that was required of him in the moment, because it wasn't just limited to print journalism. He did radio work as well. Tell us about how that came about.
Yeah, so when he got this work with the Chinese government, he was told pretty early on that they had a radio station that they were using to broadcast shortwave from the wartime capital, which was known as Chongqing. We would read it as Chongqing at the time, but in southwestern China, it was a very mountainous, threatened type. So this radio station had to make its transmitters out in the hillside in the country. And Mel would go there to first train people how to broadcast the radio and speak slowly, to enunciate, to do things. And he would also have to make sure that station stayed on the air. You know, when the city was getting bombed, he would do things like scrounge radio or car batteries to power the transmitter, anything that was necessary to make sure that radio station stayed on the air. And he worked there all that summer and really made a lot of friends through that. And then when he came back, he worked there on a volunteer basis until they were able to get someone to replace him, just to make sure that mission was able to continue.
And I want to make it clear, he was not, this is not small time broadcasting. He broadcast to the whole country on NBC from Chongqing, didn't he?
That's right. The first time, for example, that the Sung sisters were introduced to the United States, Mel was the operator of the radio show. He's the one who introduced them to the United States. He's the one who made those connections from China to the United States. And an interesting aspect of that story was that there was a dentist who was an amateur ham radio operator that worked in Southern California. And that dentist was the one sort of reliable on this end for making sure that those transmissions were received and went through and were then sent on to the NBC network, and also that they were transcribed. And so it really was quite an elaborate operation.
Bill Lasher's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about Mel Jacoby and Anna Lee Whitmore, who got married on the eve of Pearl Harbor. The book about their escape from the Japanese forces is called Eve of 100 Midnights. There was a woman that he called his fiance, Mel Jacoby did, in some of his letters. Who was that?
That was a woman named Shirley Osterland, and she was another friend of his from Stanford. Although Anna Lee had gone to Stanford, the two didn't know each other that well. So when Mel was studying for his graduate degree in there, he had met and started dating Shirley. And they were very close, and they went to San Francisco to go to shows together, and they went to plays. And when Mel went off to Asia, for the time he ended up working as a journalist the first time, they stayed in touch and kept talking about bringing Shirley out there, and Shirley would talk about wanting to go out there. But Mel kind of was more committed to his journalism. He was more interested in making sure that happened. So every time he had an opportunity to extend his stay there, particularly when he was in Indochina as a reporter, he'd tell Shirley, "I'm coming back in, 5 weeks," but then he would stay another 5 weeks because another thing would break, another aspect of the war would break. And so he kind of kept her on the, sort of on the fence for a while. And so by the time he did come back to the United States, she decided she was tired of all the waiting and all the uncertainty. And, they were close, but they didn't have the same spark and the same intellectual connection that it scenes like Mel had with Annalise.
But not at first, as you pointed out, because they did have to work together a year apart in school at the Stanford paper. What made Annalise stand out of that paper?
You know, I mean, as I mentioned, I think she was the first managing editor of the Stanford Daily, and she was really interested in making sure that, you know, in that role as the managing editor, she wasn't just, you know, slated to write women's stories and cover things like fashion and all that, you know, that she was covering the news just as much as anyone else, and that that was the priority. In fact, while she was managing editor there, the paper eliminated its woman editor position because the point was, let's just have an editor. And that was one thing that was really important. And, you know, when Mel was there, the two of them were very passing acquaintances, but wouldn't have known each other very closely.
And so, but she was really intelligent. Talk about the flashes of brilliance she showed as a young girl.
Well, I mean, she was she had a photographic memory. She was reading, you know, grown-up books by the time she was five. She pulled a book off her parents' shelves when she was 5 years old, started reading it, and just wanted to read more and more. She would type into her fingers were raw at an office job that she had to support her family when she was in high school. She took the English AA entrance exam, which was an entrance exam that Stanford required at the time, and got the highest score ever on that exam. And, you know, was just one of these people who could pick up a subject, read a book, and know it and debate it. And as I understood later, you know, I spoke with her daughter. She would be like that the rest of her life. She would just have family, you know, debates and try to really engage with everyone intensely.
A couple of great minds well matched. We're talking about Melville Jacoby and Annalise Whitmore Jacoby later on, as they did marry on the eve of Pearl Harbor. They married just days before Pearl Harbor and had to flee across the Pacific. That is the story told in Bill Lasher's book, Eve of 100 Midnights. We'll take a short break on the exchange and resume the conversation. You can join in as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're visiting with Portland journalist Bill Lasher, who's put together a handsome book about a couple who got together and actually married in the opening days of World War II in the Pacific. Got married just a couple of days, actually, before Pearl Harbor Day, and then had to flee from Manila, where they'd gotten married. We're talking about Mel Jacoby and Annalise Whitmore Jacoby. The book is called Eve of 100 Midnights, the star-crossed love story of two World War II correspondents and their epic escape across the Pacific. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange with your questions and your stories from that time in history. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. I want to pick up talking about Annalise Whitmore. Annalise Whitmore Jacoby, ultimately, brilliant, really smart child, did very well at Stanford, was the woman managing editor at the paper. But then, as you pointed out, you really had to like take jobs as secretaries at that time to be able to move up in any business, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, she was, you know, it's unfortunate that she ended up where she was. She got her first job out of college was as a secretary with the Agricultural Adjustment Administration. And her hope with that, and she had, her family had been hit pretty hard by the Great Depression. So she thought that this was an administration that helped sort of adjudicate the type of subsidies and things like that that farms would get. And she was thinking she would end up having an opportunity to help out the work that farm workers in the California, and what kind of federal assistance they were getting, those kinds of things. And it turned out that the man who headed the organization just sort of wanted to pad his own resume. Instead of having her do reports and interview some of these people, the farm workers, he just had her write his own memoir for her and type up his own memoir. So she first tried to fight him and then quit because she couldn't put up with it. And, you know, that was the kind of person she was. She wasn't just going to be someone's mouthpiece, and she wasn't just going to, you know, be a glorified dictaphone or something like that. She wanted to do her own writing and her own, use her brain in the way that she had trained to use it. And I think that that's something that's telling to sort of how she would be throughout her career, that, you know, she wasn't going to let other people tell her how to do her job. She was going to do it the way that she found was the best way to do it.
And so she met with surprising success in a fairly short amount of time in Hollywood, and still that wasn't enough for her, because she did want to talk about the human condition of real humans, not the figures that Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland, for example, played on the screen. How did Mel Jacoby then figure in her plans to travel to China? How did they reconnect?
Well, she had started putting some feelers out in the Stanford Alumni Network, I guess, that, you know, she needed to get to China, and she wanted to find someone who could get help her get there. Her interest in going there, of course, was she had MGM's permission if she could find maybe write a script about it or get some material for a film. So she sent the feelers out, and then Mel just returned from China in February of 1941, and he heard from a friend of his when he got back that there was this woman who had gone to Stanford, who had worked at the Stanford Daily, that was also trying to get out there to China. So he finally called her up, and they agreed to go get drinks together, and they talked, and Mel, again, realized what an impressive person she was. And so when he continued on to, he went to New York to meet with a variety of editors looking for his own work and a variety of other people that had some influence and some pull. One of them that he met with was the writer John Hersey, who later wrote Hiroshima and, you know, a great deal of other books. But at the time, he was working for Time magazine as well. And so through that role, Hersey was able to sort of bend Henry Luce's ear about this woman, Annalee, that had this passion for China. And so Mel sort of helped connect some of those dots. And it was fortunate that at the same time, Henry Luce and some other big players in New York City and elsewhere and in the media, also in California, people like David Selznick, were trying to start this United China Relief effort to bring financial relief to the people stranded by and harmed by the war. So they needed someone to work as a spokesperson and as a script speechwriter for them to sort of bring attention in the U.S. to this cause of what was then, you know, millions of people displaced or killed by the war in China.
Trying to get Annalee to Asia, though, sounds like it was quite an obstacle.
Yeah, absolutely. She wasn't able to get a passport for many months. She wasn't able to, at the time, you know, the State Department wasn't going to give permission for a woman to go to what was then an active war zone unless they had a guaranteed form of employment. She actually had an assignment earlier on for Reader's Digest to write about China, but because it was a freelance assignment, she couldn't get those permissions. But then finally, through getting this work at United China Relief, that they finally granted her a passport. And with that passport, she set sail in the end of the summer of 1941 for China.
How so that by the time that Mel Jacoby was working for Time in China, there'd been a war going on for 4 years already. How dangerous were the circumstances he found himself in from time to time?
Well, to put it in perspective, through the time Mel was there and from January of 1940 to the fall of 1940 when he went on to Indochina, and then again in the summer of 1941, he endured 168 air raids of the city. And that meant, you know, anything from just one or two planes dropping bombs on the capital, Chongqing, or, you know, dozens of planes dropping incendiary bombs. That meant interrupting your day every single time this happened, every single time there was an air raid alarm, gathering up all your stuff, anything you didn't want destroyed, and jumping into an air raid shelter. Fortunately, the Chinese had a pretty good system of warnings for these air raid shelters so that they could get about an hour's notice. But there was that risk constantly. And then, of course, there was the risk when he actually went to the Philippines and went out on the front lines of, you know, the dangers that are involved with being on the front lines of any war.
So when we finally have Mel Jacoby and Annalee Whitmore together in Asia now, just by the calendar, this looks like quite the whirlwind courtship.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, she arrived at the end of September of 1941, and almost instantly Mel decided to propose to her, maybe within a day of her arrival. I unfortunately don't have any letters that she might have sent to him, because later he'd have to have destroyed all his papers. So I don't know, you know, every nuance of that relationship. But what I do know is that he proposed to her. She said yes. But almost as soon as he proposed to her, Time magazine asked him to go to the Philippines, because they knew that war was getting closer and that the Philippines was likely to be the first spot where the U.S. and Japan fought. And unfortunately, you know, he had to go. He knew that he had a mission, and Annalee knew he had a mission to go. And meanwhile, she had a job she was just starting, and she had to stay behind and work at that job. And they both felt the same that they should. So, you know, it was an intense couple weeks before he left for Manila. And then once he made it to Manila, they stayed in touch, and he kept urging her to get on the next plane to Manila, because if the war started, they might be stranded. And she ended up getting on, I think it was the second to last plane out of Chongqing to Hong Kong, and then from Hong Kong to Manila. And the two of them got married the moment she stepped off the plane. He picked her up on the whisked her to a church from the chapel, and they had a two-day honeymoon in the mountains outside of Manila, but then had to come back because it was clear, you know, the war was in weeks. There were alerts every day. They, you know, Pearl Harbor happened, and then they went to reporting full-time again and stayed reporting, but lived together in the hotel in Manila until the Great Escape. And every moment of their lives they spent together for that, you know, next few months, they were reporting and, you know, hiding out in islands as they went on the run. They were sailing at night. So they spent a lot of that time together. But as you say, it was a very brief time, and it was a very intense time.
Not a young couple, I guess, by the standards of the day. They were both 25 at the time they got married. But still, was it fairly unusual for a couple to get married somewhat informally so far from home?
It certainly was. And they both wrote about how they would have really desperately loved to have had their families fly out to Manila, but they knew that it wasn't safe for their families to do that. But they also knew they wanted to be married and they wanted to do it quickly. So it was unusual, and their families were disappointed, but they got together and made a phone call to their families, and they sent them lots of letters, and they sent pictures and kept pictures and really made the best of it they could. But it was a lonely wedding. It was a wedding, you know, they celebrated with other journalists, not with their families.
Bill, did they really have any time to celebrate, to take a honeymoon as such?
I mean, there was just 2 days out in the country in a place called Tagaytay, just about an hour away from Manila in the hills. A beautiful place. I went there while I was researching this book. So they had that. Of course, they were accompanied by two pandas on their honeymoon, so that was a little strange.
Two pandas?
Two pandas that were being sent by the Chinese government to the U.S. as sort of a humanitarian gift to thank the U.S. for its support of the Chinese people and the Chinese children. And so it had been Annalee's job to babysit the pandas on her flight over, and Mel was the one who sort of arranged the hunt for them. So before they got shipped to the United States, they needed someone to watch the pandas, so it was the two of them. And so they brought them along for their honeymoon.
Never a dull moment in the lives of the Jacobys here. When it came time to get out of Manila, I mean, it sounds like their options were seriously limited. How did they do it finally?
Well, yeah, you're right. It was limited options. They knew that if they stayed, they were very likely to be executed, but they knew that all the roads were closed to Bataan. All the bridges were being blown up by the U.S. forces to slow down the Japanese advance. The bay was mined. But fortunately, Mel had been spending, once they knew they were thinking of an escape plan, he started talking to contacts he knew, and he met a couple of men who worked for a shipping company that had been commissioned by the Army to take ships out of the harbor and do things like that, help do some of the logistics in Manila. And those men said, hey, we've got a boat that's still here operating, tugging the last ships out of the river. You know, we can take you to Bataan if you need. And so Mel Annerly and one other reporter named Clark Lee decided to go. And that meant they had to wait for a phone call. And about 10 minutes to midnight, they got a call. They said, come down right now. We'll drive you to the boat. They raced through the sort of chaos and engulfed waterfront because there's so much chaos because everyone was looting the warehouses. The U.S. forces were sabotaging anything of potential value. And they jumped on the boat as its engines were turning, as these docks were on fire, and went out into the night, not sure where they were going, and sort of woke up the next day on Corregidor, the fortress where the American forces were gathering, and convinced the soldiers there to let them stay as reporters.
Well, you know, the title alone hints at Eve of 100 Midnights, that the Jacobis were not together for very long. People can Google what happened to Mel. Anna Lee had a long and full life. I'm curious to know about your own approach to this material. I mean, obviously having Mel Jacobi's typewriter given to you as a gift was something extraordinary. I love the picture of it, by the way, on the blog, eveofahundredmidnights.com. Has this become something of an obsession for you, Bill? It looks like you've been at work on this for a long time.
Yeah, I think that a lot of people would say it has. I started working on it sort of full-time as a book in 2011, just at the end of 2011. So, you know, it's all 4.5 years later, and I'm just publishing the book. It's been really a thorough thing, and I've tried to sort of flesh out every element as I can. So that meant not just that typewriter, but these old letters that Mel had sent home, these photographs. I recently bought a camera that's the same model that he used when he was in China and when he was in the Philippines, but also that one of his good friends, the legendary Life magazine photographer Carl Meiden, the same kind of camera he used. So I've been trying to take pictures the way he would take pictures. It's certainly sort of consumed my life in the first couple of years. I was doing other stories and magazine articles and things like that just to support myself, but the last 2 years I haven't been doing anything but write this book. So It's a strange experience, but I think it was definitely a valuable one.
Two really fascinating people. I couldn't think of two people you'd rather write a book about. Now, obviously, a lot more about Mellon here. You're related to him. There were lots of letters available to you. Were there as many things from that period in her life available to you?
There were some. I think that the best resource for me and for her regarding her was her daughter, the writer Anne Fadiman. She. Early on, we actually met her when I first, probably in 2008. She has always been accessible to help me understand and clear up miscommunication about Anna Lee and sort of really understand the facts about her life. And one of the best things she did was we got on the phone and she sat down with every book that had ever been written that mentioned Anna Lee and her story. And these books were special because before her death, Anna Lee had annotated them and written notes. Here's what really happened. Here's how this day went. Here's what I saw. Here's who was there with us. And so that access really gave me a personal insight into who she was.
Well, it's really a couple of fascinating people and a very fascinating time in history to place them in. And it's got its sorrows as well, but really interesting reading. Eve of 100 Midnights by Bill Lasher from Portland. Bill, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really loved it.
Okay, been a pleasure. Take care.